Hey, it's True Crime Tuesday. I'm John. I'm a 911 dispatcher, first responder. Today, we're going to bring you a tale of true crime, an actual crime that occurred in the past. Joining me, as always, is Kendra, my ex-wife and former sheriff's deputy. She's going to tell you everything that happened. Hopefully.
The growing calls across the nation to defund the police.
To end policing as we know it.
Off the charts violence in New York City. 11 people shot in just 8 hours on Sunday.
This is about the police officers, who every single day put on that uniform and they run towards danger when we run away from it.
Guns up, giddy up, Wolfpack. It's failure to stop. Number one podcast where we go to inform and entertain first responders like you. True Crime is the show where we bring you cases of actual crime. Failure to Stop is, of course, the best podcast in the world. We thank you for making the first podcast of the day or first podcast of the night. The show was originally conceived as a show that was designed to keep you awake with weird mysteries and true stories of the unexplained so that you do not fall asleep at the wheel of your police car, your ambulance, or your fire truck, as that weird case may be. Probably the weirdest mystery of all is why I'm here. But tonight we're going to bring you the case of Colleen Stan, most commonly known as the woman in the box. Kendra, currently in NCIC, listed as a missing person, but that's okay. I'll just go ahead and do the ad reads until she shows her fucking ass up. The show is brought to you by Ghostbed. Go to Ghostbed, use the offer code Wolfpack. You can save massive discounts on mattresses, bed frames, pillows, all kinds of sleep technology. The technology is largely ghost-based. You have to not be worried at all. All the ghosts are responsibly harvested. There's no one walking around with a gun, aiming it through windows at night, harvesting lives for ghost technology for these ghost beds. No, it's all just taken from the people that have already passed away, the departed. They're already out there. So we love Ghostbed because they've been a big supporter of Failure to Stop since long before I've been here. And probably after tonight when I am forced to leave, please go to Ghostbed. Use the offer code Wolfpack for massive discounts. That keeps the show going, protects us from slavery. And we, I don't know why Kendra laughs at that.
Because it's foreshadowing.
Yes. It protects us from being forced to do podcasts live from a box.
Under a ghost bed.
Under a ghost bed. Oh my gosh, it's so self-referential. It's perfect. Are you starving and you just don't want to eat a plate of boiled potatoes and a glass of water or two egg salad sandwiches?
This is getting dark.
Go to Factor Meals. They can have food brought right to your house. That's right. You don't even have to leave your house for even 8 years at a time. You could just have the food. You could just have the food brought right to you in your home. Over 300 options. And they can be brought right to you. Go to the website. Use the code WOLFPACK50. You get 50% off of anything you find there. They'll bring it right to you. You could just have them leave it at your door. You don't have to let them ever see your face. The delivery driver doesn't have to wear a blindfold or a box on his head or anything before he approaches the door. They'll just leave it there. No big deal. Wellness company. Somebody downstairs who's vitamin deficient after year after year after year.
This is so fucking bad. Oh my God. Sorry, continue.
It was going okay until you showed up. I was having much less fun. Wellness company is a company. She's gone now. The wellness company is a company that brings you pills also to your house. They have them delivered right to you. They have a whole bunch of options for you over there too. If you need help with your digestion, your metabolism, if you're dealing with starvation, depression, if your sodium levels are low because all you do is cry quietly all the time, you know, you could go to wellness company. And they could deliver you the supplements that you need to survive even the harshest of captivities. Go over there and use the offer code Wolfpack. Wellness company. Solutions designed by top men, Kendra. Top doctors. Top men. We appreciate wellness company. And I don't know that wellness company appreciates us folding the story so much into their corporate ethos. Or whatever, but they are supporting us, so we appreciate them. Also, Kendra, I don't know if you are interested in talking about a little company called Zaps Chips. Clear your throat first.
Well, last week we talked about Zaps in prison, and I just wanted to clarify that that doesn't mean like a jail after you've been convicted of a crime in the court of law. It could mean a prison of your own mind. It could mean a prison that was fashioned from the mind of a lunatic that kidnapped you while you were hitchhiking to your friend's house. Anywhere is a good place, really, to enjoy Zaps chips. Here we see pictured their voodoo-style chip, which is my personal favorite. It's like a barbecue salt and vinegar type chip. And I do enjoy them while I'm in the prison of my own mind, crying quietly, listening to Ken Burns in the background tell me about the Civil War, and what a plot twist, let me tell you. Again, I don't really know why they won't call me back. If you've heard from them or you know of anyone that works at Zaps, if you could just tell them, like, I'll stop showing up at their houses and sending cryptic letters if they just call me back. Anyway, Zaps.
All right, that was a pretty good Zaps ad read. I would just mention that they're the chip for the snack that won't quit or something. If you just make it rhyme and keep it real quick, you generally don't get sued. So something to keep in mind for next time. Also, oh, okay. more seriously, fuck, I'm about to start the show over, Kendra. Gatekeeper Coffee. All right, so there's this company that's run by two corrections officers, and they make delicious coffee. I mentioned it in passing because I thought about partnering with them at some point, that might be a good idea. And, you know, they don't know what to make of me. I think it takes a little bit of time before they figure out whether or not I'm a serious person or some kind of charlatan or whatever. And I mentioned them on the show last week, I think, or 2 weeks ago.
Yeah.
Kendra said she was going to get the Mexican chocolate coffee. And she said right after the show was over, she was going to go do that. Well, Kendra kept her word. How was the coffee?
I ordered two blends. I ordered the Mexican chocolate, which is amazing. I drink my coffee black, so I prefer flavored coffee, and I can, because I drink it black, I can taste like if it's good coffee or not. And right. It's really good coffee. I got that blend, and I believe I just got the original blend. Obviously, I also got a shirt to rep. It's really, really good coffee. I don't know what else to say about it. I really enjoy it. I drink it every morning. So
very good. Is the shirt made of cotton, or what is it made of?
Yeah. It's cotton. I think it's a blend. It's a cotton polyester blend of some sort. Okay. Maybe a 60-40. That's how it feels.
Anyway.
Yeah.
All right, Kendra, let's do the show. This show is about Colleen Stan, the woman in the box.
Yes. Did you know about this case before I suggested it?
I did. At one time, I saw some documentary. It might have been the Netflix Unsolved Mysteries episode that was actually about the disappearance of... I think her name was Marianne or Mary Ellen Sponicky.
Mary Elizabeth.
I'm sorry. I don't mean to misremember the name of a dead person. But it was all kind of about her. What did you say?
I said, how dare you?
Well, it's too soon. Anyway, it was mostly about her disappearance because even though we have a damned good idea of what happened to her, and even though like in recent, just two episodes ago, we proved that, you know, you can take a case to court and you don't have to have a body and you can win a murder trial. Our suspect in this case was never charged with her murder, but he was charged with a whole bunch of other fucking shit. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you want to take us back to classic true crime setting. Imagine it's the 70s. Yeah. Everyone's acid finally just burned off. We're all listening to Jim Morrison and Jimi Hendrix and the Doors and Vietnam has just ended, and Jimmy Carter is driving up prices really high and through inflation, and it's summertime and everyone's hair is still long for some reason, and it's we're gonna hitchhike, right? A young girl's gonna hitchhike, and I know what you're thinking. She's gonna lose both her arms.
I actually thought about Mary Vincent a lot when I was researching this case because it happened somewhat around the same time frame. And it's very similar, obviously, like the hitchhiking and all this stuff. And Colleen was a self-proclaimed like professional hitchhiker, or she was very experienced because that's how people got around back then.
Yeah. Actually, what made me mad about this was in preparation for the show, I was listening to a lot of British podcasts about this. I quickly turned them off because they were awful. But in one of them, they're just like, my God, she's going over 400 miles because they can't even compute that on an island like England.
I know.
They're like, we would be in Germany if we traveled that far. And they're like, why is she hitchhiking? Doesn't she know how dangerous it is? Why doesn't she just take public transportation? There is not public transportation from Eugene, Oregon to wherever she was going in California.
Westwood.
There's no fucking public transportation that will take you that far.
I know. They don't comprehend that America. I don't think even Americans understand how big America is and how many different people we have here. But we're going to get sidetracked. I could talk about that for a long time.
I completely agree.
But Colleen was hitchhiking to go surprise one of her friends that lived in Westwood. Like you said, she's from Eugene, Oregon, and it's a pretty far, that's a far trek. I mean, out there, I guess it's not that far. It's not crazy to imagine that someone would go travel that far for a friend. But anyway, because she's so experienced, right? She kind of like knows the ropes. She's getting around, and she turns down a couple of rides because she notices that they're kind of sketchy. Like one of the cars that pulled up had like a bunch of dudes in it. And
first one had like five guys in it. Yeah. That was a good sign. Actually, I think the first one was like a trucker that tried to cop a feel, right?
He did. And then she said, let me out right now. And he did.
She's assertive. She's a strong will, strong mind.
And unlike Mary Vincent, she's an adult. She's 20 years old. So, I mean, not that that matters. You're still very young, but, you know, she's lived a little bit of life, a little bit, and she knows what she's doing. She knows what to look for. So she's going along. She has probably like, she doesn't have much longer in her trip. She's trying to get there before sundown. And a vehicle pulls up with a man and who she assumed was his wife and their baby. So this seems like a pretty safe scenario, right? Like I would probably think that if I'm hitchhiking, that's the car that I would get in.
Yeah.
In comparison to the other ones.
The woman and the baby are really what makes it safe. Yeah.
Correct.
What it seems safe.
Yes. So I almost called her Mary. Colleen hops in this vehicle. She's got about probably 30 miles left in her trip, 40, 30 miles left in her trip. They start casual conversation. They're just talking about like, oh, where are you going? What are you doing? Who are you? How are you doing? Blah, blah, blah. They're making casual conversation, nothing too weird, but they stop and get some gas, probably like 15 minutes into their trip. And Colleen goes into the bathroom to wash up and she's like, her spidey senses are going off.
I was going to use spider sense. I don't even know why I'm here. I get ready for the show, and when Kendra talks about how she had like women's intuition to figure out this is a bad idea, I'm going to be like, she used her spider sense. And then you just steal it.
I'm sorry. I'll only stick to the facts and be super boring so you can be the entertainment.
Say the things that I'm not going to say.
Okay, she had
woman's
intuition.
She was overcome by an urge to run away.
Yes.
She had feelings of dread. You know, this whole time she's like the people are talking to her and asking her about herself, which is kind of engaging, but they're like, oh, so you're traveling out to California? When are you going to get there? She goes, oh, you know, hopefully soon. Who's waiting for you? No one. It's a surprise. So like, if you never make it there, no one will ever know, huh? And she goes, I guess not. You know, and they don't ever say anything about them. And so she's overcome with this dread. And then she comes out of the bathroom. She's getting ready to leave. She sees the family and they're like, you want a Zagnut bar? Things have been a little bit tense. We got you a Zagnut. Come on. And she's like,
we got you a bag of Zaps.
I don't think Zaps existed in 1977, did they?
I don't think so either.
Or whatever year it was. Was it
77?
77. 77 seems like an evil year.
A lot of things happened in the 70s. True crime was, the 70s was a big time for the true crime. And the 80s. And I mean, all times are true crime times. But
I don't like true crime in the era of the internet, because I think a lot of this, the really cool, interesting stuff all went away once everyone had a cell phone, you know?
Yeah, there's no, like, it's not shrouded. Everything, all the information is out there for literally anyone to access.
I think what we should do is, the next time we take on a case from the 70s, we should pre-plan a little bit. And then, despite the fact that we're a true crime show, tell the story as though everyone involved has a cell phone. And then just explain why it wasn't a big deal. And then the episode ends after about 8 minutes.
Okay. Sounds fantastic.
So Colleen Stan calls a ride share for the gas station.
She calls
her. Her only options are to go with this creepy family that's bothering her, or like be rude to them, which, you know, there's a little bit of social pressure there. And then she has to say, you guys leave. I'm going to stay at this petrol station, as the British people said. And they're going to leave. And then you still have to get another ride and then try to get the hell out of there and get to where you're going. So,
yeah,
no matter what you do, no matter how good your intuition is for avoiding gropey truck drivers or basically a mobile gangbang unit with five men. With the five.
Fake taxi.
With five guys. Yeah, I mean. You know, no matter how good your intuition is, you're always placing yourself at a disadvantage when you're hitchhiking. So remember to take a ride share, take public transportation.
I mean, genuinely, like, the idea of hitchhiking nowadays is so incredibly frightening.
Would you do it if you had a friend? Like, if you and I were trying to get across the country, would you hitchhike with me?
If you and I were doing it, yes, because mm-hmm. you're a man.
Here's the problem. No one will pick us up because I'm such a big guy. So here's what we got to do. We're on the side of the road. You go out there and you do the thing where you're, I'm going to say, Southern Belle.
Yoo-hoo!
Yes. See, this is why I would go with Kendra. She knows what to do. She knew to go straight to Yoo-hoo. And,
You need to get a rag. Excuse me.
Yeah, so rag, and you would do declare. And then I do think you might flex your calf a little bit out on the road just because you're stretching. This is just to gather attention.
And then
as soon as the guy is like, you know, hey, Dollface, where are you going? Because he's from like the 30s New York or whatever. You explained, you know, we're trying to get out to Hollywood to start our career in the film business, motion pictures. That's when I come out carrying a big duffel bag and then maybe a kennel with an animal in it. I'm like, let's go. And then he's just like, there's not room in here for two. But because we live in the era of SUVs, there's always going to be room for me. That's how you and I are. I know. It's such a good story. We should do that instead of the show. Why are we here?
Let's do it on a Patreon. We need to do that. Anyway.
Going on with Colleen Stan. We're 20 minutes in and this is a long story and we're not going to get it all done.
So anyway, she gets a spidey sense. She ignores it. She gets in the vehicle. They make it probably another few minutes. They're not far away from her destination. And the male, whose name is Cameron Hooker, by the way, and his wife is Janice Hooker. It's kind of funny that Hooker's picked up a hitchhiker. I don't know. Anyway, Cameron says, there's these ice caves. There's these cool, like, natural, like, phenomenon thing that I want to go see real quick. Mm-hmm. And we're going to go do that.
Colleen, do you mind if we get you in a dark underground place as soon as possible?
Exactly.
And she goes, so, yes, of course.
Please, please, by all means. please
take me to the mines.
Take me to the mines. I want to be... Never mind. Anyway... They show up, they park.
Oh, this pesky sun. It's so depressing.
The vapors. Janice gets out with the baby. They go down to this lake that's there. Colleen declines to get out of the vehicle because she's starting to freak out a little bit. And she thinks, well, the best case scenario to not prolong the trip is to just stay in the car and hopefully they'll figure out that she doesn't want to do that and they'll leave. Mm-hmm. Well, Janice gets out, goes, like I said, down to this lake with her baby. Colleen recalls watching them playing, and then all of a sudden, she's like, where's Cameron? He jumps in the back seat with her and takes
like Alberto the knife from Futurama. He's got the knife.
He has her at knife point, sticks a knife in her throat, and says, are you gonna cooperate? And she was like, yes. So he handcuffs her. and he puts this contraption over her head. It's a box.
Let's describe it. So it's a box that has a latch on the bottom so that when you put the box on your head, you can't get it off. Total sensory deprivation. It's like sculpted on the inside to fit on the head. It's like got carpet in there, so like muffles, yeah. And it's super hot. And so this thing like latches around her. It's so tight on her throat. She can barely get any air exchange. She kind of feels kind of strangly. Here's the interesting thing. This sounds like it came out of Vietnam, by the way. This seems like a totally VC thing to do to somebody. If you're all of a sudden sensory deprived of pretty much everything except touch, you are helpless at that point. There's really nothing you could do. And so she is now with the box on her head at knife point. There's nothing she could do. So they put the box on her head. They throw her own sleeping bag on top of her. You got to remember, she's now swelteringly hot. And here's the kicker, because there's always one part in these true crime cases that makes it a little bit worse. They put something else on top of her. The baby. They put the baby on top of her so that when she's riding around, she doesn't thrash or do anything because she doesn't want to hurt the kid, obviously. I just thought it was really lame and shitty that they put the baby on her. Then they go to a Burger King.
Yep, they just casually go to Burger King and get a cheeseburger. Like, this is just a normal, everyday family outing for them.
Yeah. I don't know that it was Burger King, but I'm imagining that it was.
Some sort of fast food hamburger joint.
Fast food, because she could kind of smell the hamburgers and she can tell what's up. And anyway, they go through the drive-thru or whatever. So then they finally get to where they're going, and darkness has fallen. In fact, at one point, Colleen was very worried about getting to her destination before dark, and she was worried this ice cave diversion was going to make them too late. And of course, this guy Hooker's like, no, we'll make it on time and all this. And he's, he's just like, we'll have you home soon enough. And she goes, well, I'm not going home. And he goes, oh, right. Sorry. I didn't mean to tip my hand about what's going to happen to you. And she goes, what do you mean? And he goes, nothing. Whoops. Anyway, none of that happened. So they take her home. Sorry for that fake crime interlude. So they take her to the house. Darkness has fallen. They are going through up some steps or steps into the kitchen. She can kind of see the stove. She kind of has an awareness that she's in a kitchen. And she goes down the steps. Now she's in a musty, moldery old basement, 14 by 23 or something like that. Not very big. And there's a beam across the ceiling. Kendra, did you want to tell this part or did you want me to tell this part? Or
I'll tell this part because I can tell you probably don't want to talk about it, and I will talk about it.
Oh, I'm a professional. I could talk about it. I don't want you to talk about it if you feel like it would put you in a weird spot.
It's not going to put me in a weird spot. I chose this case.
Oh, right. Well, then you do it. I don't want to do it. It'll make me feel weird.
Okay. So Colleen is now in this basement of this home that they brought her to, which obviously is their home. And as you mentioned, there is a beam across the ceiling to which a hook is dangling. And Colleen is taken by the handcuffs that she was fastened, secured in. And she is strung up on this hook. And immediately upon stringing her up, Cameron begins whipping her. And
she's Colleen, already nude, by the way.
She's nude. She's got the box on still.
There's pictures of pornography all over the room.
She can kind of see. They might have taken the box off at this point. I can't remember details that, but she had a blindfold on regardless.
She had a blindfold on too. For months, she had a blindfold on.
Yes. And she could see kind of under the blindfold a little bit. If you've ever been blindfolded, you can kind of see under it. And she notices that there are underneath her, scattered across the floor, are porn magazines. And one of them depicts a woman hanging from the ceiling exactly how she's being hung.
It's like she's basically hanging by her wrists. And then I think, was there something else around her neck? Maybe. Anyway, she's definitely hanging. She's got pain in her shoulders and her back. There's a box under her feet that gets kicked out at the point where she is literally just hanging by her wrists at one point.
Yes. Very painful. And she's being whipped and sexually assaulted and just like being tortured immediately, pretty much.
There's a table that's beneath her, that's the rack. And at one point she looks down beneath the blindfold and Mr. and Mrs. are getting it on underneath her. Disgusting.
Yeah. Janice comes in to the room after probably putting their baby to bed, which is disgusting. And they proceed to have sexual intercourse underneath her while she's hanging from the roof. And I'm just this. This case, for whatever reason, this has never happened to me before, but it made me very emotional. So I might cry at some point in this episode. I'm not going to lie.
That's what I'm here for, is to get you through these terrible, tearful moments. I will be aloof and dispassionate as always, just telling the facts of the case and like maybe like up to 13% falsehoods, just because I like
living
to get
on
a
mountain.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Inside joke. Anyway. So once they're done having their fun, right? They take Colleen and they secure her to this rack that you mentioned. And this rack is like it's like something out of a BDSM porn, right? And he built all this stuff to get by himself. Like he built these contraptions, and later we can talk about his mindset and his relationship with Janice that will kind of help us figure out why the fuck he's doing this in the first place. But he straps her to this rack. He stretches her out. She's got the blindfold on. She's nude, and she stays on this rack in that position for like a month, 10 well, days or something like that.
What it is they put her up. Yes. I mean, you're right. There's a whole breaking in period for her, but her daily routine is something like this. She's kept on the rack all day long. She's manacled hands and feet. While she's laying on the box, or when she's laying on the rack, she has the head box on. So she has it on like all the time, 23 hours a day. She's got this thing on. An hour a day, Cameron comes down. He's very, very unkind to her. Has her use the bathroom in a chair that has like a bedpan underneath it, like what you would put an old person on. Feeds her leftovers or basic food. And then puts her, chains her up in the Y position up on the beam, whips her, takes photographs of her. Sometimes the pain is so bad that she passes out, and then it's back on the rack. And then she does this day after day after day after day. And, you know, when she's inside the head box, all she could do is, you know, think about how, you know, no one in Westwood was waiting for her. She's wondering if anyone's looking for her. She does have a boyfriend. She does have family, but you know, no one has any idea where and when she disappeared, so they don't really have a way to start looking for her at all. And at one point, Janice comes in while she's laying on the rack, and you know, Janice opens the box or whatever, and Janice tells her, like, "I want you to understand something. You're pretty much here to take the pain for me, but you're not going to be." Raped. He's not going to have sex with you. So just so you know. And then Janice asks her, like, well, what would you do if you got away from here? And Colleen's like, I would tell the police I was kidnapped and beaten.
Yeah.
And Janice is like, well, that's the wrong fucking answer. And Janice closes the head box on her and tells her that if she leaves, it'd be the same thing as committing suicide. And leaves. And one, you know, the thing is that Janice is very cruel to her as well. But there's weird interludes where sometimes, like, they give her like moments of bizarre, like very, very modest kindness. Like at one point, she's cold when lying on the rack. Janice gives her a blanket, which then Cameron, of course, I'm sure, takes away. When she refuses a meal, at one point she gets whipped for that. So at one point she's just like, no, thank you, I'm not hungry. Because, of course, she's lost her appetite with the situation. She gets whipped for that. It gets to the point where she's been down there so long, you know, she doesn't have any conception of how much time has gone by. You know, think about it. Like, without knowing the difference between day and night and how long you're in a place, like, you have no conception anymore. You become kind of totally untethered from reality. You're literally, you're the sensor deprivation, just being in your own thoughts all the time, living in constant fear. Like at one point, you know, they'll give her some random scraps of food that are delicious, you know, French toast or whatever, like normal meals. But eventually she's in such poor health, that she stops having menstrual cycle. Like she, like her body is so completely fucked up from being abused and mistreated, and she's malnourished and all this. That goes away. Well, when it comes back, she gets, you know, obviously abused again for that, for having that happen. And so she's allowed to take a bath, but then, you know, because we can't just have a nice thing, she gets basically, I wouldn't call it waterboarding because that implies like a complicated setup, but Cameron like grabs her by the hair and is like holding her head under the water until like the last bubble comes up, and then he pulls her out so she can take a breath, and then he dunks her again and then takes pictures of this, you know, very, very horrifying. And yeah. This goes on for a very, very long time. Eventually, you know, her birthday comes and goes, her 21st birthday. The year changes over. Christmas is over. She had been abducted in the spring, so she's coming up on a year. And it's just been a very, very long time of constant pain, constant torture. And I mentioned the Viet Cong earlier and prolonged torture and kind of the effects that it has on guys that are trained for combat. Colleen Stan was 20 years old when she was abducted. And even though she's, you know, she has enough assertiveness to feel confident enough to travel alone across various states, and confident enough to, you know, fend off the advances of a truck driver, she's very vulnerable, and she's getting very broken down, and she has very little hope. And her situation becomes darker every day, Kendra.
Yeah, that's just like the tip of the iceberg for her experiences that she goes through. And we're not going to go through all of them because one, there's way too fucking many. And two, they're absolutely grotesque and disgusting.
How long was she actually in total in captivity? 8 years?
I believe 7 years.
7 years. Yep. Because the trial started in like 84, right?
Yes. So, well, she was held captive between the years of 1977 and 1984, which is 7 years. But she, there were different phases of her captivity that she went through. Obviously, that's a very long time. And she was, the setting we just made is a very like dark and bleak one, but it doesn't probably begin to even like, I can't fathom it. But there were different phases of her captivity. She was graduated, I suppose, if you want to say that, from the rack to a box that was like built like a coffin. And this box was stored underneath Janice and Cameron's bed. Inside the box, she would be inside the box blindfolded. He would wrap her up in chains, her sleeping bag chains, and also put earplugs in her ears. And she would be in this box for 23 hours a day. She was allowed to come out for 1 hour a day to eat, be tortured, get back in.
And this box, by the way, is made out of plywood, and she's in there nude. She's got chains around her neck and her ankles. Plywood, like, not a comfortable thing to touch with even your hands, let alone like the parts of your body that, you know, think about just your legs and your back. You don't want to be laying on this. She's in there 23 hours a day.
Yeah. And it's small.
She's kept under the bed. Yeah. I mean, it's exactly like a coffin. And she was put in there because she was making too much noise. At one point, she needed something and she was rattling the chains on the rack or whatever. And that's how she wound up being put into the box. And we got to remember the hookers, they've got a child in the house. So, like, this child is growing up while there's a woman being kept in a box under
they
the
have.
Box.
Janice gives birth to a second child on the bed while Colleen is under it in her box. And Colleen, the entire time that this is happening, she is blindfolded, by the way. She doesn't physically see her captors until like 3 years after she's been imprisoned, mm-hmm. mind you. So she's living in total darkness, in absolute despair, in absolute agony, in hopelessness. And when she does, you know, she's done a couple of interviews, spoiler alert, she lives, she's alive right now. She's out in the world doing good things for people. And I almost feel bad even covering this case because it is very raw and vulnerable what she went through and the things that she experienced and the fact that she survived it. And she talks about there were times where she wanted to give up and just die. I mean, who wouldn't? But she talks about going to good places in her mind, and she replayed fond memories, and she would fantasize about Thanksgiving with her family,
future, yeah.
Going on picnics with them just to get through. And at one point she says that she would imagine herself being visited by angels that would open her box and tell her it's going to be okay. And at one point she said that she would talk to God, and she would talk to her grandfather who passed away, and he would come comfort her while she was in the box. And that kills me.
Yeah, that had to be tough. That you're looking so deep for anything to give you hope that you're thinking about the things that matter the most to you, your family, your friends, trying to envision some kind of plans for the future. You know, we talk about people with suicidal ideation and how they stop making plans for the future. And she, despite everything that's happening to her, she has a very, very indomitable will to live. She has mm-hmm. a will to get through all of this, through the pain, through the humiliation, through the torture, through the apathy, the indifference of these people, the bizarre set of circumstances. But there's another component of that, because although her will to live is very, very strong, there's also, I don't want to call it brainwashing, because brainwashing, the way that it's portrayed in a lot of media and books and movies, it's all very commonly misunderstood. Colleen Stan's a 20-year-old woman. 20-year-olds today are very naive about the world. They don't understand that the way the world works. They don't understand how it takes place. But particularly in an era where towns were smaller, the internet was less prevalent, we didn't have access to worldwide information at the drop of a hat. No one could just Google anything. No one could just know anything. The world's largely unknown. Like, you know your life experience and you don't really know anyone else's. That's what it meant to grow up in an era before the internet. I hate to tell you that's what it was like, Kendra, because I know that you have no idea, but it was a lot more fun back then. But anyway, what happens is one day, you know, Colleen is in captivity. And Cameron comes down and says, well, they found out about you. The company man is here. And she goes, what does, you know, that mean? She's not actually allowed to talk, but she's wondering.
Mm-hmm.
And Cameron explains in great detail that basically there's this thing called the company. And he's a part of the company. And his dad's a part of the company. And many powerful men across the world are part of the company. Police officers are part of the company. Basically, the patriarchy, all the entire authority complex, everyone's in on this. And what's amazing about it is that, especially today, it seems kind of realistic that powerful people might be involved in human trafficking. I mean, I think we can almost concede that that is real, right? But what Colleen was led to believe was that this company exists and that it's possible for a person to completely forfeit all of their human and civil rights and become the property of another person. And Cameron explains to her that he pays these membership dues and the cost of her being kept as a slave is $1,600, which is a lot of money in 1977. And basically, if they don't get her fully documented as a willing slave, having signed this contract over to sell herself into slavery, that there's going to be all kinds of problems, and that she's going to be sent to a re-education camp in California where she'll be properly broken so that she can make a good commodity on the slave market.
Well, this guy's good.
I know.
It's like he's turning the tables or something. Damn, he's like some reverse psychology evil genius.
Cameron says, I already know a guy that actually wants to buy you as a slave. So, like, you know, she's put in this situation where, like, my God, like, this is real and this is all above board. And, like, if I leave, like, the company's going to, like, hunt me down and they're going to kill me and resell me to possibly a worse situation. And Cameron tells her stories about how Janice, his wife, you know, was one of these slaves that ran away, and he, you know, captured her. And she had been, at one point, she had been like, they'd like done some sort of grotesque physical torture on it that left her like with permanent injuries with her knees or something. Maybe Janice had a bum knee or something, and so he blamed that on some fake made up story about what happened to her. But
yeah,
anyway,
the story he made up was so
elaborate.
I would believe it too if I was in Colleen's position.
Especially after all this time. Well, because he acts so confidently and with absolute impunity about what's going on. So he goes on and on and on and on. And here's something that I just found interesting from my standpoint, and maybe you do too as a police officer, but there's actually something very powerful in having someone make a deal with you and commit to something. Like Kendra, I'm sure that you have had to deal with suicidal people before. And something that we do is we make them promise that they're going to be safe. And to a person like me who doesn't understand how any of that goes, I'm like, as a civilian, you're like, okay, so someone's going to promise you they're not committing suicide tonight, and you actually expect them to not do it based off of that word? Yeah, we will very often ask people like, will you make me a promise? You know, if we've built a rapport with them and we're able to influence them and say, will you make a promise to me that you're going to be safe tonight? A lot of times that will work. And we do the same thing when we do crisis negotiations. A lot of times, you know, if we're getting some rapport going, some influence being built with that person, we might get them to promise to just hold off and wait to get an answer to a question, or might get them to promise to just, you know, and these people, despite being in positions of power or positions to do whatever they want or to not keep their word, they will actually do it. So he said he has her agree to sign over her life to him. And this is all very like 50 Shades of Grey kind of type stuff, but basically he's got this nice document with this nice calligraphy on it, and it's all, you know, I, Colleen Stan, promise to do so, to become basically your loving sex slave, and I have no rights, and I'm not allowed to do X, Y, and Z in your presence, and I can't stand higher than you, and I have to kneel before you, and I'm not allowed to speak unless spoken to. And
there was
go ahead.
There were some things in there, like you are one of the things that was like really kind of this whole thing is disturbing. But one of the things that was in the contract was that she was not allowed to cover her vagina at any point in time. Like she wasn't allowed to cross her legs. She wasn't allowed to wear underwear or any garments that would cover it, because he needed to have access to it at all times, whenever he wanted to.
Just a power thing, right? It's a part of their dynamic that she doesn't have any body sovereignty. She doesn't have
She doesn't own
dignity.
Herself.
Right, exactly.
She doesn't have any autonomy. She's a sex slave, and that is it. She's not a human being, is essentially what he's trying to get at. He makes her change her name to K, just the letter K. And by the way, he's going by Michael Powers. Right. Because Colleen doesn't know their true identities ever at any, well, until the end, but at any point in time during her captivity, she doesn't know who they are. They're not giving her their real names. It's Mike and Janet Powers. And he has her sign this contract, but she's kind of reluctant because she tells him like, you know, I don't want to sign this because nobody owns my soul except God. I'm not giving my soul to anyone except God. Yeah. And she just has this like, she has this way about being realistic about what's going on, even through all of the torture that she's been put through in psychological torment. And she signs this contract, which makes Cameron extremely comfortable. I think he makes him feel a little more like, okay, well, my brainwashing has come to a point where I can kind of trust her a little bit more. So at this point in her captivity, she's allowed to kind of roam the house a little bit. She becomes known to the neighbors as like the live-in babysitter.
She
gardens outside. At one point, they move houses. And when they move from the original home to a trailer, they're a little more secluded. But for the most part, everybody knows that she exists and that she's there. Even to the extent that Cameron allows her to write letters and correspond with her family. And what's even sicker is at one point, he allows her to go home.
Yeah, there's an occasion in which she shows up and her dad is there, her mom is there, her stepmom is there, which if mom and stepmom are in the same room, you know, maybe they had an amicable divorce, but everyone really cares about Colleen to the point where like they all like are gathered there to receive her. And you got to remember at this time in the 70s, like we all remember, you know, the 70s. We talked about that briefly, but there's a lot of cults in California. They assume that she went off to be some sort of to live in a commune or something. Well, she shows up and she used to have like beautiful long hair down to her waist. It's been cut because at one point, you know, she's been so mistreated. She's gone all these months without bathing. Her hair's all messed up. It's been in a box, right? So, I mean, that can't be good for your hair. I know I'm kind of making light of it, but she's physically transformed. She's bony. She's small. I'm sure she has very white skin. She's ashen. She's vitamin deficient. Her clothes are homemade. So she's totally transformed by her experience. And she doesn't really talk about what's happening. The family doesn't want to push her too far.
Right.
Because you're like, my God, why did you fall off the face of the earth when you were hitchhiking to somebody's birthday party down in California? And you like, yep, you left your boyfriend behind and he has no idea what happened to you. And so they try not to push her too far in it because they're worried that, you know, if they're overbearing, that she's just going to be like, you know, I can't do this. I'm leaving immediately. So they just try to be loving and just be loving towards her. And she's there, and I guess she has a conversation with her sister. And then while visiting at some point, the phone rings. And Colleen, despite being a visitor in the house, this is the part that kind of confuses me, but she answers the phone. And she just says, yes, sir, which she's only allowed to call this guy, sir. And he calls Janice, madam, or whatever. So then you could see her whole visage, you know, her appearance just kind of sinks. Like, you know, she's having a good time. She's being around people who love her. She's being reconnected to all the people she's been fantasizing about for years. But she can't bring herself to tell them what's going on or to ask for protection or whatever because she's afraid of the company. The other thing that he told her about the company is like, look, if you try to talk about the company, you get away, you explain what's going on, we're going to kill your family. And yes, of course, this is something that we see a lot. It was in The Green Mile, but it's like the way that you control people is not by threatening them with death. I think a person at some point will reach a point where they're willing to die to escape you. But they're not willing to sacrifice their friends, their family, their cause over to escape that suffering. So she's willing to suffer and to be separated from their family in order to preserve them because she feels like they're in danger.
Right.
So this guy shows up. He says, yeah, we're actually engaged to be married, which I think is also part of his fantasy. I think he loves the idea of having multiple wives. But he says, you know, we're just in town for a conference. I work on computers. But the conference is over, so we're going to get on the road. We're going to head back on down to wherever we came. And they're just like, well, we would love to stay in touch with you, Colleen. What with us loving you as our family member? And, you know, you guys obviously have, you know, this... You guys are getting married and that's great and we would love to get to know both of you. So where can we reach you? And they're just like, well, we're in the process of moving, so we don't have a phone number right now. Here's another classic 70s story that would be ruined because if someone today had a cell phone, there's no way for you to deny that you have a phone number, right? Like if someone just says like, yeah, I you know, cell phones are a fad and I'm gonna wait till it's all over and I'm just not gonna do that. Very suspicious. Everybody's got a phone number. Anyone can be reached at any time. This is totally outside of our culture, the idea that you don't have any way of getting in touch with someone. All the letters she sent over the years, there's no return address. Everything's been very one way. Colleen has not said like, you know, I'll tell you how you can reach me. She's just like, she's evasive about it, which also kind of makes the family wonder like, you know, what's going on there? She's not asking for help. She's not asking, you know, she doesn't even seem to be like sending these things coded because she's worried about the family. And so they get on the road and, at some point, I don't know if this is directly related to that, but this is a picture of Colleen hugging the guy.
This picture, this is so sinister. This photograph, if you're watching, was taken at her family home by her family. She had them take this photo of them to convince them that they were engaged and they were in love. And if you did not know what the story was behind this, this is very convincing. This looks like a loving couple that are happy. And it just, I think it speaks to just how fucking sick and depraved this asshole is. Where he, which by the way,
smile for a picture with the family of the woman that he's been raping and torturing for months.
Absolute ball sack do you have to come into her family home and just have the confidence that she's mine, she ain't gonna do shit. Mm-hmm. Which obviously that's the case, but like the fact that to me, it shows that he has absolutely no limits. There's no shame. He doesn't really care. He does not give a fuck. And I bet you he was high on that moment, being around her family, knowing that he had such control over her, that she could be this close to freedom, and she chose not to take it. It wasn't a choice. But they go back from the family home, back to their trailer, and this is something that comes up in these types of cases a lot, where a captor will give their prisoner a little bit of freedom just to take it away, right?
Yeah, to break that last bit of hope. Yeah.
Yes, Colleen goes through this with her family and everything. She's, like I said, she's been out of the box, like living normally. She's been at one point he had her making macrame pieces so they could sell it.
Well, the first instance of that kind of being a source of productive income for her was pretty early after, you know, she was taken captive and put in the box. They created a space, I guess it was under the stairs in the basement, where she could shell walnuts.
Right. Sandwood.
Sandwood and walnuts. And so they had her doing that, basically that piecework. I don't know if the walnuts were for sale or if that was just another form of torture, because shelling nuts by hand is not something
it's not comfortable.
No. And if if you're forced to do basically an unlimited number of nuts, it's not like you could just quit when your fingers hurt or whatever. And these are walnuts. So I don't know if she's even got like a set of crackers or whatever, or a pick or anything. This is not exactly peanuts that she's cracking. And so it's a form of work for her to do, which I don't think she necessarily minded, just because it gave her a diversion, something to do, time out of the box. But still another form of exploitation and torture for her, and an example of how they used her for work. And some of the letters that she wrote to her family, she said she had taken up gardening, canning things. I mean, I'm sure that's another example of things she was being forced to do around the house. Right.
Exactly. And they just, when she was free from the box, they put her to work like that. She did form bonds with their children. By the way, this entire time this is happening, there are two children being raised in the home and they have no idea what's going on. But she was, even when she was free at night, she was chained to a toilet. Like, she wasn't allowed to be. And she would chain herself up and lock herself. Like, that's the mindset that she was in at this point. It's probably like four or five years in at this point. That's a long time. That she probably adjusted to that as her new normal and just made it her life, because you're not leaving at that point. Right. But when they get back from her family home, she goes back in the box. And not only does she go back in the box, Cameron forces her. And I keep saying Cameron because he's the mastermind, but Janice is also participating in a lot of this. Mind you, she was also a victim of Cameron's at one point. But Cameron makes Colleen say goodbye to the neighbors that have gotten to know her, to tell them that she's going back home with her family, so that they don't really miss her. Like, they don't ask where she went. She went under the bed in a box. Can you imagine the psychological torment of saying goodbye to neighbors that you've bonded with, because you know you're going to be stuck in a box under a bed? It's so bleak. It's so bad. And this poor woman. But she does have another bout of freedom towards the end of her captivity. She comes back out of the box. I think she was in the box again for like 6 months, 6-8 months or something like that. this is at the point in her captivity where Cameron's really considering maybe marrying her, and he even starts incorporating what he called cuddle time in her torture sessions, which is fucking disgusting. So I think that he's actually creating some sort of bond with her, and he ends up bringing her into their marital bed, which really pisses Janice off, because we haven't really touched a lot on Janice and Cameron's relationship, but before Cameron decided to hunt a slave, Janice made a deal with him that he could do this if she gave him a baby and didn't have actual intercourse with the slaves, right?
Right. Let's talk about Janice a little bit though too, because she was a girl, was raised by parents that didn't think much of her. I don't think that she did especially well academically, making friends, things like that. Kind of an outcast.
Yeah.
I think that her parents were worried that they would never get rid of her, that she would kind of be hang around forever. And then when Cameron comes along and acts like a knight in shining armor, even though I believe she was underage at this time, and he was older.
Yes, he was 15, or she was 15.
She was 15 and he was older. I'm sure he was age of majority then, I take it, probably.
Like 19?
19. So, yeah, across the line there. But basically, the parents were happy to get rid of her. And I think Janice didn't enjoy living with her parents either. And I think she was looking for anyone who would kind of help her out of the situation with her parents. So I think there was sort of a hopelessness for her and her future on the part of both Janice and her parents. Whatever that means, just that she just wasn't a strong person, or she wasn't going to flourish, or she didn't have ambition or whatever. So the parents were happy to get rid of her, and yeah. Cameron was happy to have her. And so she's, you said 15, and Cameron's just like, you know, I'm pretty experienced sexually. This is, you know, the kind of sex that I like to have. He describes it, you know, it's BDSM, basically. It's hardcore shit. And, you know, she's naive, completely inexperienced. She's probably in a position where she thinks no one else will ever love her again. Like, this is it. Like, you get one shot at love, and this is how it's happening for her. She doesn't realize that, you know, you know, if you have self-worth and dignity and a lot going on for you, that there's many people that can fall in love with you and be attracted to you, and you can have your pick. I mean, life is like that. There are people who don't think they can do that. And so she winds up in a relationship with Cameron, and it's painful because obviously he's whipping her and doing all the things that he's probably doing to Colleen, because that's what gets him off, right? This is what makes him happy. And you know, at some point, he's obviously got fantasies about, you know, having a harem, and she's willing to kind of indulge that as long as there's ground rules for it. And if he's hearing, hey, you know, you can actually do these things as long as you just, you know, don't do A, B, C, and D, he's willing to do it. So she concedes to that, in that she doesn't take any more whippings. So she gets out of the painful part. She gets to have a baby, which is probably something that she's longed for as a woman and as a married person. She's getting some semblance of some normality mm-hmm. on the condition that the worst parts of her relationship get passed on to someone else. It's right. Still very sick. It's very sick, very awful that she's willing to basically, I mean, think about it. She's out there with her baby, out there with Cameron, the day that they're driving that blue Dodge Colt down the road and see Colleen Stan. She knows that Cameron's hunting for a human slave
mm-hmm.
and allows it, doesn't warn her, doesn't do anything, sees the box that's going on the head, does very little to help her. Actually, the psychology between Janice and Colleen makes perfect sense, that there's a real animosity there, right? Like, these two women are both suffering in unique and different ways, and one is being... You know, to save herself, she's transferring a lot of that grief to that person. So she can't bond with Colleen, because then she would feel guilt about it, right? So she's definitely going to keep Colleen emotionally distant, because she doesn't want this, everything happening to Colleen, to happen to her.
Right.
And of course, Colleen can't understand any of it. She can't understand why a wife or a woman could look upon what was happening to her with anything remotely close to approval. So how could she have any kind of, you know, real relationship with, Janice or whatever. So just amazing dynamic there. Really sick, really twisted. But Cameron's hurting everybody in different ways, and although there's certainly a lot of blame to go around. We needed to understand who the wife was in all of this before Colleen Stan entered the picture.
Yeah, and there's a lot of podcasts that cut her a lot of slack, and I understand that because she was a victim. She's a victim of Cameron, right? I do believe that there comes a point though where you, especially in Janice's case, because you still know right from wrong. You still understand what's going on. And now that the terrible parts of your relationship are taken off of you and they've been put onto someone else for 8 years, or excuse me, for 6 years, 7 years, I feel like you have time to reflect on what's going on, because you're not being, I'm going to get hate for this. You're not being physically coerced or abused. And yes, mental and emotional abuse is very real. I understand that. But you still have the ability, even when you're being abused, to understand what's right and wrong. And I think we can cut Janice some slack to a point. But there is a point in time where she participates in the torture as well. So I don't think that I don't subscribe to the whole Janice is a victim and we shouldn't. No.
Well, we can understand Janice without condoning her. We can do that. We can understand it. So what's going on? So she initially agrees to this thing. It's happening. Maybe she thinks it's temporary. It gets longer. It goes on. There's no exit strategy. You don't know how this is going to end. And I think eventually, because people are endlessly self-justifying, like no matter what, a person justifies what they do in their own mind.
Right.
A person never really reckons with the fact, like, what am I doing? This is crazy. This is wrong. I've got to stop. It's always a way of putting things off, or we'll fix it at some point, or we'll find some way to make this okay. But ultimately, I think it just becomes the norm in your household. And more than that, more than the norm, it becomes a secret. And everyone's in on the secret. And I think all families have secrets of some kind. Case in point, in my family, my house was filled with trash all the time. We were knee deep in it. It was a hoarder's house. My mom did not take care of the place. My dad was overseas very often. My house was filthy, filthy, filthy beyond comparison. We'd been investigated by Child Protective Services. We went on the run from the cops for like 2 weeks. At one point we had to like abandon the house and leave and go live in another house. At one point we had two houses. I don't even know how the hell we paid for that. We wouldn't be able to do that these days, but we had a new place we were living. And I was going to the school where my old house was, so I couldn't take the bus to get to school. So like I was always late to school, and it impacted us in a lot of ways. And when we got to the new house, I was like, you know, none of this is really gonna last. I was in sixth grade, seventh grade. I said, the problem with the old house wasn't that the house was filled with trash, it says there's something wrong with us. As people, there's something wrong with us as a family. It was really my parents, but do you see how I involved myself in it? I said, I'm a part of this. I said, I'm responsible for this because I'm a kid and I'm sure I contributed my share of crap to the house, but I made myself as much a part of it as anything. I said, you know, I'm involved in this. This is my fault. I'm part of the reason why we had to abandon this house. And I said, the problem is really us. So I knew what was going on. I knew a sense of right and wrong. I knew a sense of not being normal. But in that, there was also shame. Like, we never told anybody what was going on at home. And even when people would find out stuff, you know, when someone would knock on the door and you're opening the door and you're like closing it behind you so no one can see in the house, which is weird. There's stuff like that. I mean, I could tell you 100 stories, but like in the new house, I knew it was a matter of time. And sure enough, that house became full of garbage too. And, at one point, a water pipe broke, and our bottom floor was filled with water for years. And we never told the landlord because the house was trashed. And so we just lived that way. And it was a family secret, and we just dealt with it. And, you know, even though it wasn't my fault specifically, I lived in filth and squalor and, you know, gross, bad conditions, dangerous conditions sometimes. Mm-hmm. We had an oven, a gas oven that wouldn't turn off. So it was hot all the time. And we also had a flooded first floor. So like if the pilot goes out, you know, we all just could have died at any point. That was just normal life for us. So I don't mean to make this like sad times for John, because it's like, whatever, other people go through weirder and worse stuff. But my point is that when you have norms in your family and you know that they're only the way that you live and the way no one else lives, there's a lot of shame built into that. And there's a lot of secrecy. And whether or not it's your fault, you don't tell anybody. I can really understand that part of it. I can't understand bringing someone into that situation.
Right.
I can understand never talking about it. And I can understand never taking personal steps to fix it.
Right. And I think that the shame, because people focus a lot on Janice being a victim, and they, I understand that we just went through that. It's all very understandable, like you said, but it's not condonable.
No.
And Colleen, some people have not criticized, but they asked the question, why didn't she tell her family? Like, why? That shame plays a role in that as well. Of the fear.
I mean, how is she supposed to tell her family? Like, well, on day one, this guy right here took my clothes off, hung me up from the ceiling and whipped me. Like, that's shameful. That's embarrassing. He completely took away her dignity, and he did things to her that shamed her so bad for so long that she didn't want to talk about it. Case in point, not to skip to the end, but when she finally is no longer a part of this household, she doesn't go tell her family. She doesn't go tell the police. She carries this thing with her, and it's not even over for her necessarily, but I don't want to ruin the story. I know that we're going to get there.
We're getting to that point pretty much now anyway, because I mentioned earlier she went back in the box for a while, and then she comes back out and she's kind of given a little bit more freedom again, even to the point where her and Janice go out like as friends on the town, and they like find guys and hook up with them, which is crazy. But they do that. they did that one time. And then I think that was a test on Cameron's part for Janice as well as for Colleen, to see how much control he had over them. And when they came back willingly, and Cameron did give Janice permission to have an affair, which blows my mind, but
probably to appease his guilt, whatever guilt he had.
Yeah. And she brought Colleen along, and they started to bond a little bit, even though Janice was experiencing a lot of jealousy, because Cameron did eventually have intercourse with Colleen and broke the pact that he made with his wife. But over time, Janice kind of got over it, and she started to bond with Colleen a little bit, and her and Colleen got jobs as maids, working at a hotel.
Just like the outline of a sitcom coming this fall to CBS.
Yes, of course. At this point, Colleen's been held captive for 7 years. We're in 1984.
Right. When she went into that house, Carter was president. When she came out, Reagan had already completed his first term. That's how long she was fucking in that house.
Yes. I mean, in the grand scheme of life, like 7 years doesn't sound like a lot, but
a lot happens in seven years
of that. Yes. A lot of things happen in 1 year, let alone seven. And that was her life. But anyway, Janice, I think the bond that she started to create with Colleen, and just being like, you know what? I'm jealous of the fact that my husband, you know, is now having this relationship with Colleen, but I really like her. And she's starting to get really confused. I don't think she ever experienced this before. She's starting to doubt Cameron. So she confides in a coworker. And this coworker tells her...
we all have that conversation. She's like, man, my husband's had this woman in a box under the bed for 7 years. And
I hate it when that happens.
I got to be honest. It's really starting to throw me. It's starting to affect me.
I'm now suffering, so I care. She confides in this coworker, and the coworker tells her, like, girl, that is not okay. And you need to go to the police. This is not okay. This isn't healthy. And for the first time, I think probably in her life, Janice had somebody opening her eyes to this.
Validating her.
Yes. And her guilt starts to set in and sink in, and she realizes, you know, Cameron ain't shit, and we could just fucking leave. And she goes to Colleen and she says, while she's at work, she's like, oh, hey, just wanted to let you know. The company, not real. My name's Janice, and that's Cameron. You should get the fuck out of here, because you can, and nothing's going to happen to you. So,
can I tell the most disgusting and favorite part of the story?
Sure, go for it.
So Colleen decides to leave. She goes down to the bus station. And this just shows kind of how wrapped around Cameron she is. She calls Cameron on the phone, on the payphone. She says, I'm at the bus station. I'm leaving you. Cameron cries. The woman that he abducted and has kept under a box for 7 years says, I'm leaving. And he takes it like she's breaking up with him. This whole time he has been indulged in a sick fantasy that they have a relationship that's based on love and affection and is somehow normal. And it's like a part of his family is leaving. And he cries about this. I don't know if he's crying because of the love being lost or the relationship ending, or if he's crying because he realizes, well, I don't want to be held accountable for the things that I've done. I've been avoiding that this whole time. I wonder if he's crying because he feels sorry for himself. But as I alluded
probably
to earlier,
probably a little bit of both.
Maybe. She leaves, doesn't call the cops. She's got so much shit. Just being outside, being independent, being on her own, making a decision for herself, talking to a stranger, exercising some of that autonomy that has been stripped away from her. I honestly believe that was enough. Like she has drastically and radically improved the status of her life already. That to think about, you know, going and talking to a police detective, explaining these things that are going on. I think that it's just something that takes time to explain. We recently covered a case on Comm Center. We were talking about those three women in Ohio that were held inside a house for 10 years.
Yes.
Totally different situation. You know, they broke out the door and they were rescued and they were happy. I think the difference is that we're talking about the 1970s versus the early 2000s. I think it was a very, very different situation. I think first of all, a child being born in the house in Cleveland was a whole other situation, but Colleen being kept in a box was a whole other level of torture, the head box, the whipping. I think it really did a number on her, and I think she needed time to get her head clear before she could address all of this. But not only that, but like, if there remained any lingering doubt about the status of the company, about whether or not she would face some sort of reprisal, if the police would even believe her. I mean, how do you go to the police and say, for basically 7 years, I was kept in a box and whipped and tortured and degraded by this guy, you know, this guy who looks like this, you know, are the police are even going to believe you, you know? I think that was a huge part of it, Kendra.
Yeah, I hate to like be that person. But I think a lot of people could probably relate to this, where you've been in situations like that, where not to the extreme that Colleen was in at all. But I think most people can say that they've been in some sort of situation that brought them shame because they can't believe that something
that they allowed it
to happen, that they didn't do more to make it stop. And especially in this, like, imagine going through basically creating a life for yourself around this sick and depraved mind, then to realize it was all fake and you could have left at any moment. And this person made you believe that you were worthless and that no one cared for you and that you can't trust anyone and everyone you go to could potentially be part of this company.
She had to feel pretty foolish.
And why... It sounds fantastical, right? Like, obviously, as a law enforcement officer, if somebody came to me and told me that these things were happening to them, I would be skeptical initially. I would take the report. I would talk to them. But I would not immediately be like, oh, my God, this is terrible. I would think
break down a door. Yeah, you would think that they were making it up. Some drug use, some confabulation.
And that sounds horrible. I'm just being honest. Like I said, I would still do my job.
Hold on one second. Hold on. You're saying it sounds horrible and that you would still do your job. We can understand you, right? How often is a police officer going to have someone come to them with a story like this? Now, in the annals of crime, we have our Elizabeth Smarts, right? We have our the three women up in Cleveland. These things happen, right? Women get taken, held captive for a long time. This is actually like surprisingly normal, like in terms of criminal behavior. It's not every day, but it's like the fact that I was able to come up with like five examples of that, including this one. It's troublesome. But the average beat cop police officer, if you think about the kinds of crimes that they deal with in the course of their career, they're going to have maybe one extraordinary case of something that's worthy of going in a book or a true crime podcast. Maybe a couple, depending on where you live. But the average sheriff's deputy, Kendra, is not going to have someone come to them with a story like this. And so no. Your disbelief is totally understandable.
Well, you also have people that do, unfortunately, exaggerate and ruin things for real victims because they do make things up. Not anything necessarily that wild, but still, it's hard to tell who's legit and who isn't. Because you do deal with, especially as a patrol cop, like you said, a beat cop, like you're dealing with a lot of crazy people. Like, you deal with the brunt of society on a daily basis. All of the, like, shit parts of society that... It's funny because I know it's a little sidetrack, but the city I used to work in, I have some friends of mine that live there. They're not cops. And they tell me that they really like living there because it's really safe and they never have problems. And I'm like, what? Because I see it. I mean, people don't see their community for what it really is. Like, when you're law enforcement, not all you deal with, but the vast majority of what you're dealing with is just the absolute gutter of society or bad situations, like people having the worst moments of their lives. That's all you see is bad moments in people's lives. So
you're completely right.
You can change it a little bit. Yeah.
And if you want to ruin your own peace of mind, turn on the police band radio, because you'll think that you live in a pretty decent town. I thought that I did. And now that I can hear the radio in the town I used to live in, how many times a night am I hearing calls going out for weapons violation? Man with a gun, man with a knife, man with a machete, man with nunchucks, man with samurai sword, man doing this, man doing that.
Oh my God. I have a story for you.
I know you do. Well, you're samurai Florida sword. You're a Florida woman. How could you not have a story that would fit this situation? But my point is, turn on that police band radio. Listen to the stuff that's going on around you every single night. You're going to hear in progress reports of burglaries, robberies, rapes.
Right.
Don't just wait for the news to get you the distilled version after the fact of what came out of it. Listen to all the stuff that doesn't make the news. Like, the news is only going to pick up the most salacious. You're going to find that violent and terrible crimes are happening every single evening and even during the day sometimes. But let's take it another step. The common person could do this. Open the sex offender registry website. Look all around you. Think about whether or not your kids should be walking home from school. Whose house are they walking past? Take it another step further. Become a dispatcher. Be able to look up the address history for anywhere in your jurisdiction. When have the police been there and why? That apartment complex on the corner? You wouldn't believe the terrible stuff that has gone down there.
Oh,
you don't
want to
get an apartment there. That place is fucking haunted for sure. And it's every apartment complex. And it's every hotel. And once you get access to that level of information as a dispatcher or police officer, you will realize that society is a thin veil, a facade. And the stuff that goes on every night between 11 p.m. and 4 a.m. while you're sleeping, nice little dreams. You would not believe the fucked up shit that's going on. Kendra, do you agree?
100%. Because I've heard people say, like, oh, this such and such is a nice place. And I'm like, No, it is not. But anyway, let's
Part of the reason I bought my house is because when I looked up the house to see the history, I'm like, oh, the person who lives here got a speeding ticket once. That's pretty damn good. You know, like, that's all it was.
This is not a shit house. This is not a shit bag house.
So, yes, going back to Colleen Stan, she leaves. Yes. And then because Janice gets jealous of the situation when Cameron basically wants Colleen to become his second wife. You know, one for Chorn and one for Horn, I guess, was Cameron's mode that he wanted to do. But anyway,
fair.
Fair. And, you know, so she eventually leaves. And how does the situation eventually end for the Hooker family?
Yeah, so kind of a plot twist here. A couple things happen. So Colleen stays in touch with Janice and Cameron after she leaves. She talks to them on the phone every once in a while. Like you said, she does not contact law enforcement. She doesn't want to talk to them. She has no energy for it. I get it. I've been there. When you're just done with something, you're fucking done with it. You don't want to. And when you get police involved and there's an investigation, it is ongoing and you get re-questioned and you get, they say re-victimized. Sorry, that's not a thing. But anyway, I digress. Janice leaves with, not with Colleen, but at the same time, she leaves Cameron initially. Right. But unfortunately, she caves. She goes back. This is short lived, luckily. And Janice is again confiding in somebody who tells her, you need to contact the police. And one of the points that they brought up was, you have two daughters who are at this point almost basically teenagers. And they were like, what do you think? Why do you think he's not going to do this to them?
Yeah.
So this kind of drives Janice to say, like, you know what? You're right. I'm fucking done with this guy. And she goes to law enforcement. She speaks with a detective, tells him that my husband is responsible for the missing girl that we talked about at the beginning of this episode. Marie Elizabeth Spanicki is how we're saying it. Spanicki. They were out hunting for a slave. Janice was pregnant at the time.
As one does.
And kind of the same situation where they picked her up hitchhiking and they were doing the side of the road thing or pulling over for a distraction, right? Well, she gets out and Cameron kind of just yanks her back in by her hair, takes her captive. Unfortunately, shoots her in the stomach with a pellet gun a couple of times and ends up, I think, inadvertently killing her by strangling her.
It was the first attempt, right? How many in the history of serious and dangerous and psychotic people, the first one doesn't go so well, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, even BTK had, you know, he had a one time where, was it him or was it Golden State? I think it was BTK. He breaks in and then he gets into a fight with a guy named Kevin. Right. And then he's never able to do anything to the woman because Kevin gets involved. Kevin dies a hero, but he gets out of that situation without getting to bind or torture anyone. Just kill one guy.
Yeah.
So even BTK had a one off. Not every, you don't have to be great every single day.
And, progress, not perfection. Yeah,
right. And so, right. That's what they want to see from you someday on a true crime podcast is that you got twisted, more twisted and more weird and more proficient as you became.
Sure.
You know, whatever you were. So yeah, he had a misfire with Mary. You said Ellen was her name?
Elizabeth.
Mary Elizabeth. I'm sorry to her family and to her Spanicky. I had a misfire with her, but don't worry. He worked on the kinks out of the system when it came to Colleen Stan.
Oh God. So she tells law enforcement about this and they're taking it very seriously because she's been missing for a while. And they basically say, well, we'll grant you immunity from any responsibility with the Colleen scenario if you testify.
I think it was too generous, to be honest, don't you?
Yes. I think because she got nothing.
She didn't get anything at all. You got to plead her down to like accessory or something. I mean,
right. Accessory, at least. And, you know, it's like he didn't even get the murder charge because they couldn't locate her body, unfortunately. So. But it opened the portal basically to to Colleen's case. Mm-hmm. And he was eventually taken into custody and taken to trial. And the court proceeding was kind of crazy because there was the people who can't fathom this type of thing, this type of dynamic between two individuals where someone is brainwashed into staying in a horribly abusive situation.
Yeah.
That was kind of the defenses, like, well, she could have left and she didn't, so obviously she liked it. Like,
right. Well, at one point, when she was allowed to have a little bit more autonomy in the house, she was still being told to sleep in the bathroom.
Yeah.
And at one point, she's sleeping in the bathroom, and I think the door's latched from the outside, but for whatever reason, they didn't latch the door from the outside. So at one point, the little kid went in there and found her sleeping, and they're just like, damn it, slave, you need to lock yourself in the bathroom when you're in there sleeping at night. And so she complied with that, so she locked the door, and so the defense is just like, she liked living this way. Like, she's a twisted freak. She liked it, you know, which makes you the world's most disgusting attorney. I get that you have to do that, but like, man, can you just imagine being that guy and having to say those things and then seeing yourself in the mirror? I can't imagine there really is a lawyer who's slimy enough that could do that. I mean, maybe there is, but
they were doing their due diligence.
Due diligence. No one can ever say it. Did you know that if you spelled due diligence with a J, it would change nothing about the pronunciation of it?
Yes, because D's and G's are very... D's and J's, wow.
Oh my gosh, you're bad at the alphabet.
I have to go home now. So anyway, and I'm out of focus now.
Focus in.
Cameron is taken into custody, brought before a judge, goes to trial. Even despite all of the like doubts that the defense attorney is trying to put in the jury's head, the jury does, they take everything into consideration. Colleen testifies, Janice testifies. They do find the physical evidence of the box, the rack, a couple of other things in the home, because of course, when Janice went back to Cameron the first time, they got rid of a lot of evidence.
Probably, yeah.
Because they were worried about her inevitably calling law enforcement, which she never did. But the jury deliberates for 3 days and they find him guilty on like 10 felonies for kidnap. Now, the laws were different back then. So I think it was kidnap. Obviously, sexual, like rape. And there were a couple of other little charges in there. I can't remember what they were off the top of my head. But regardless, he was found guilty on all of them, and he was sentenced to 104 years in prison.
Spoiler alert, he's still there.
Yes, but there's kind of like a...
He's about to be released at a grade school near you.
It is possible that he may be released later this year, unfortunately. He is a violent sexual predator. That's that's his category in California. His status, if you will.
Yeah.
In California, apparently they have hearings and trials on these things to see if the person could still be deemed as a violent sexual predator, right? Because they believe in rehabilitation with that kind of stuff, which, whatever.
Well, he also might be so old to the point where he's not able to harm anybody. I wonder how old he is now.
Well, he was born in 1953, so...
Oh, he's not that old.
But anyway, he was initially supposed to have the hearing in March. It got pushed back to August. On August 16th, he's supposed to go before it's a jury trial.
Yeah.
And if he is not... If he's deemed a violent sexual predator, he'll stay in prison. If he is not deemed a violent sexual predator anymore, he'll be sent to a halfway house, which is frightening. But he was eligible for parole a couple of times, and ironically, COVID messed it up.
Yeah.
So they wanted to just release him in 2021 because, you know, we had this like crisis where the prisons were, it was a problem.
Prisons and jails. But yeah, he's only 70. And if he's been taking care of himself, or if he just has good genes, he's still a threat.
Absolutely. So we'll be looking forward to that. As for Colleen, she, unfortunately, this is the part that reminds me of Mary Vincent a lot, where she tried her best to just live her life, right? She got married, had a kid. Neither of those really worked out. Her kid's kind of fallen off the rails. I mean, who would expect her to be a functioning individual after all that?
She's got too much trauma and PTSD and everything else, and no one can relate to her, and she's haunted every day, I'm sure, still.
Yeah, and that makes it really hard to be vulnerable and emotionally available for the people that need you the most, like your children, right? So it just didn't work out. But she does do advocacy work, and she's a social worker, and she works at like a crisis organization for people that go through domestic violence in situations like this. So she is doing her part to give back. And from the interviews that I watched, she seems like a very kind individual. And looking at her and talking to her on a surface level, you would never know, which makes you but it really makes you think every person you come into contact with, like, you really don't know what somebody's been through or going through. But the fact that Colleen could go through that and go on to live a semi-normal life and then also give back and do good things.
Yeah.
Amazing. Amazing.
It is. It's it is amazing. There's quite a few documentaries on this. I think I've watched, there's an episode of the new Netflix Unsolved Mysteries that talked about it. The horror movie, The Poughkeepsie Tapes, was loosely based on this. I think there was a Law and Order SVU episode, which I don't know how you adapt that without, you know, making it, first of all, four episodes long and completely, like, you have to blur out everything to be on TV, but...
Because it's TV, John. They solve it in one day.
I'm sorry. They solve it in one day. But lots of other documentaries and things like that, too.
There's a Lifetime movie about it.
There's a lot of bad podcasts about it.
Yeah.
I know you wish I probably had a clip, but I'll just out them instead of playing a clip. You know, why help their numbers at all? But it was called Red Handed. And there was a meme recently that was about how, like, listen, I don't care if you're British, just don't do it in front of me. And these these two girls on this podcast, they're both really, 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 really British. And you listen to them for about 5 minutes and you realize why the fuck we kicked them out of this country as soon as we were able to, because they are fucking annoying. They immediately get on this jag about anti-religion this and how talk to your kids about sex and all this, and really, really preachy for two people who hate religion. And I'm listening to this and I'm just like, just get to the facts of the case, you know, like, and immediately just like, you know what, I hope I haven't listened to enough of this for you to get any kind of credit. Really fucking awful. And then I'm looking at the cover art for their podcast, and they have won like 3 British awards for being the best podcast ever in Britain. And I'm just like, holy fuck, like, they're awful compared to me, you know? And they're getting all these awards and they have all these ads and all this. There was another one I listened to. This one wasn't bad. I should look up what it was called, but it was one of these podcasts where I think it was the one where they drink the beer. It's like they have a craft beer and then they talk about cases. I don't know, which is a nice thing, but it's scripted. And then at one point they're reading all their 5-star ratings and reviews, and they're just like, "We love your show so much. It has truly changed the way that we live our lives. It is so exciting every single week when your episodes drop." I'm like, "Do you hear yourself?" Like, and at one point they're just like, "Steve, have you found a new beer for this week?" He goes, "I have, and it's extra cold and foamy." And she's like, "Do you like the taste?" And he goes, "Yes, it is good." And she goes, "I'm glad." And I'm just like, you fucking scripted this out, but you didn't even write a funny script. If you're going to write what you say, at least make it bizarre and hilarious, you know?
We just do that off the cuff.
We just get on here, and sometimes it shows, right? Like, we're not always excellent, but we are always like our true selves. We're truly extemporaneous, spontaneous. We're our true selves. But I think we should do a show in which I just write the script well in advance, and we just sit here. We just sit on the show just reading our scripts the entire time without inflection, because apparently, and they had a lot of ads too. Apparently, that's what it takes to get ads around here. I think I'm electric and very dramatic. And I think the chemistry that you and I have cannot be beat. But do you know who doesn't love you and me?
The British.
The British, but lots of people with ads to throw around. I mean, my thanks to Ghostbed. My thanks to Factor Meals and all that. They like Eric. Where's the ads for Zaps? True crime. We are such a damned good show. Maybe some of you can't tell, but I do love you guys. I'm only here because of you.
Is this a thing? I don't want to do that.
Oh, I don't know what you're doing. I don't know what that gesture is.
They're different types of internet hearts. I don't know. I think they have different meanings. So sorry if that was inappropriate, but I
think you just signified your allegiance to the Crips. So I don't know what you did. Guys, Kendra's in a gang now.
I gotta go.
She has to go. She has to go to gang practice, everybody. She's gonna go get jumped in. So
by the disciples? Who are the people that you were in prison with?
I was in with the gangster disciples, yeah.
The gangster disciples, that's it.
I am now a gangster disciple. So believable.
Slancha.
All right, guys, that was the Colleen Stan case. I actually do love you. Thank you for listening to the show. I appreciate anybody that shows up and watches me do anything. And I appreciate especially anyone that shows up and watches true crime. Do you know why? Because in truth, this is a show that I like doing very, very much. And people can see me anywhere. I'm on a 1 in 5 of all podcasts on earth. So for people to show up and watch this podcast, the one that I put a lot of heart into and a lot of energy and effort that I love doing with Kendra, my wonderful co-host who has won our hearts and minds, I appreciate it. All right. So tomorrow's Wednesday. Eric's gonna bring you all the news you need without feeling depressed. Thursday, we're going to talk about sports. My God, sports still happening in this world. Friday, a big case breakdown that will blow your mind. Monday, we'll be back here with comedy. And then, of course, the best show of the week is on Tuesday. I'll say that till the day I die, unless I'm not on the show anymore, in which case I won't talk about it. You guys have a good week. Guns up, giddy up. Good night, America. Don't get yourself true crime. Goodbye, Will.